Campus FM presents a talk organized by the Archaeological Society of Malta entitled The Malta Survey Project 2008 Scope and Preliminary Results of a Joint Belgium-Maltese Fieldwalking Survey in Northern Malta.
My contribution is supposed to be just an introduction of 5 minutes, not more, because the hour that we are permitted to take is quite crammed with the contribution by Nathaniel Kutaya and by Nikki Bella. I just want to say two things, namely that, to give you the background of field walking surveys in Malta, without in any way diminishing the extreme value of this particular field walking exercise. You should be aware that there have been in the past at least two attempts at actual field walking surveys. The first one was a very modest one, actually initiated by Anthony Luttrell. Those who are not as old as I am know that Anthony Luttrell was an authority on medieval Malta. He contributed greatly to the start of serious medieval studies in Malta, and it was in the 70s when he asked me to join forces together with a student at that time, a certain Helen Skenas. I suppose since then she has changed her surname, to conduct a very short survey, a walking survey at the area of Hassaptan, and try to perhaps identify by this survey the location of this lost village, which forms part of the list that had been compiled by Godfrey Wettinger, as you know, in 1975, and the publication edited by Anthony Luttrell, Medieval Malta. Godfrey Wettinger produced this interesting article about lost medieval villages. One of them was Hal Spitale, or Spital's village, and nothing to do with hospital, Hassaptan. And we did conduct this survey. In actual fact, the physical work, the field work, was done by Helen Skenas, which actually made selective collection of pottery from each field. Each field was marked, was given a number, marked on the appropriate survey sheet, and the number corresponded to a bag with the same number, full of pottery. To be honest, I don't know where that pottery was deposited. I have to inquire, just in case, whether it is with the La Terroir. Perhaps if I go back to the meeting this evening, I'll check that. So that, I have managed to find some files of the surveyed area in my office. There could be a possibility now that we have a postgraduate student who has dedicated herself seriously to pottery studies, we can actually dedicate some energy on that, the study of that. The second survey was much larger, much more ambitious, and it was intended to undergo a transect, a strip all along Gozo, from one end, from the east end to the west end of Gozo. And it was undertaken concurrently with the excavations at the Brockdorff Circle at the initiative of the Cambridge, Bristol at that time colleagues. And every year a number of participants in the excavation, including myself, on two or three occasions I actually took part. I don't know whether anybody else did, probably Trisha did. On one or two days we went on this field walking survey, and they adopted more or less the same method, but now properly with a number of people actually walking side by side with a couple of meters on each side and picking everything, not just pottery, even rifle charges, what do you call them, cartridges. And so, in fact, at the end of the exercise, in putting in the information data in a computer, one could see on the map how concentrations of hunting cartridges, the right place to shoot at birds. But that was, but in any case, eventually the group decided to concentrate on pottery as well. That was stopped with the interruption of the excavations in Gozo. I hope that they will, the project will be resumed sometime in the future. I know I'm aware that a number of discoveries were made, because I used to correct, as we now do, the what is called monitored fieldwork of students who take part in the excavations and then draw up a report. And I remember mention of the discovery of even Roman sites, and perhaps the most important site that was discovered at that time was the one on the side of Kakulyat, which perhaps not all of you know about, which probably is probably Neolithic, and showed also even Skorba pottery, grey Skorba, possibly not so much, but red Skorba pottery, which is a rather unusual in Gozo. Okay, now we have, of course, this particular project. It's been a godsend. All the funds are coming from abroad, from the University of Belgium, the Flanders project. Dr. Vella will explain better what it is. It is, in fact, the result of an initiative of Dr. Vella together with the representative of, be careful with that bust, I'm seeing it moving, together with our colleague Roald Doctor, who occupies the chair of classical archaeology, Greek archaeology at the University of Ghent, that this project started. And in fact, 2 weeks, 3 weeks were spent last September, a very intensive field walking in the area of Bidnia, with very rewarding results, I can assure you. But you'll be hearing about those results in a moment. I just want to express again for the second time, I did so in Gozo for the Gozo project, to express my satisfaction about this collaborative work, collaborative research project. In this case, it involves again the superintendents of cultural heritage and the Department of Classics and Archaeology of the University, but in this case also a foreign institution, that is the University of Ghent. The atmosphere was, apart from the very intensive work, very friendly, with mutual respect, and it was a very admirable situation. In fact, I've had the opportunity of hailing this project in my address at the beginning of the European Association of Archaeologists meeting last September. So I don't think I should keep you anymore. I'm sure that the most interesting part is in the PowerPoint presentation that is following. All right, thank you.
Okay, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for coming to hear about this project. I'm very pleased to be able to talk to you on behalf of a large team involving both specialists, undergraduate and postgraduate students. The results which I will present to you today are very much results, interim results, but I think you will be able to see quite interesting thoughts being put forth about the history of one part of Malta. As Professor Bonanno said before, this is really a joint project involving the University of Ghent in particular. And even though Professor Roald Doctor is not here with us this evening, I did discuss with him the format of the presentation, and we agree on what I shall present to you today. Please note that the lecture is being recorded for Campus FM, and in the Department of Classics and Archaeology webpage there will be shortly available the PowerPoint presentation that can be downloaded. So besides the audio, you will be also able to follow the visuals that will appear on screen in the next 20 minutes or so. So the Malta Survey Project, the scope is very clear. It is an intensive field walking survey in a kilometer wide transect in northern Malta, even though our particular interest is in the Punic period, in the period really that starts from about the 2nd century BC and goes into the early years of the Roman occupation. The background to the project is really a meeting that was held in Lisbon a few years ago. It was the International Conference of Phoenician and Punic Studies, and there I took part in a session on the Punic rural landscape. You see here on the right-hand side the proceedings of that conference. And over there I spoke about the lack of information related to Punic rural sites. We know Malta most especially because of a number of tombs that exist in the countryside. We also know a lot about the distribution of Roman villas on Malta, but we know too little about Punic rural sites. And there I was really complaining about this big lacuna. And in the audience there was Roald Dokter, who had just been awarded a massive grant from Flanders through the University of Ghent, and he was receptive to what I was saying. A few months later, he contacted me and he said, "Would you be interested in the University of Ghent coming over and doing a field walking survey in Malta?" And of course, with all that money being offered, besides the expertise that Dokter could actually draw upon, the answer was yes. And with the superintendents and with Professor Bonanno's help, we did quite a lot of work to get the paperwork signed and a collaborative agreement drawn up, which is quite an exciting venture. It was also one of the very first times that the Maltese team at the university were working with someone who was not British or Italian. So this offered a very, very interesting new opportunity, and we were quite excited about that as well. The aims of the project are really three, and the first one is to understand the exploitation of an island landscape long term, and I will tell you why. The emphasis is on the long term, using different techniques, starting with a geomorphological study, systematic survey, geophysical prospection, being able to look at what is underground without actually digging, and excavation if the opportunity arises, with an emphasis, as I said earlier, on the Punic period. That is the first aim. The second aim is very important, and our idea is to create a reference collection of diagnostic sherds, which are period specific. And we do that because we do know that once we collect sherds from the surface of the fields, those are going to be abraded, and we need to compare them with something which is clear and well known and well studied. So that is going to be the second aim of the project, to create a reference collection to which we can compare the material which we shall be collecting, which actually we collected in the field. And aim number three is to provide students with training in field walking methods and techniques and finds processing. Part of our duty at the university is to provide students with the sort of training, and it is quite an exciting part of the project because it is the students who do all the work in the field. And it's the interaction between specialists and students that results in the interesting thoughts, insights that we get. What about the method that we have used during our survey? The survey took place in the area of Bidnia. I will show you a map in a second, over a two-week period between the 1st of September and the 15th of September. And the method is quite straightforward, because it involves walking in a straight line over fields, which are usually fallow, round about late August and early September. Some of them would have just been ploughed. And we look carefully, walking in a straight line, at the surface and collect the pottery sherds that are encountered in the field. And that is as simple as can be. That is the exercise. But of course, you can imagine that with terrible temperatures, the exercise can be quite taxing. But it keeps us very fit indeed. And we had quite interesting results after 2 weeks of this first campaign. The problem we were facing when putting together the project is, what area should we survey? Where do you start? And we decided we had in mind two areas. We had in mind an area around Bulebel in the south and an area in the north of the island. And we went for the north because the terrain there is quite variable, and we wanted to cut across different topographic features, the basin and the valley floor, the ridge and the plateau, and so on and so forth. To cut right across them, we would get a representative sample of the landforms in the north of Malta. One problem with the Gozo survey is that it just missed one of the major valley or flat areas, which is the Ain Sealem valley floor. And as we know, that is the area where one prehistoric hut is known to exist. So the idea, knowing what the shortcoming of that survey was to try and include also basin floors in our survey. Of course, it is always going to be a sample of all Malta's and Gozo's landmass. And on a map, sitting at the office of the superintendents, we said, okay, this is where we could concentrate on. These are four transects, each a kilometer wide, starting roundabout from the Victoria lines and extending northwards. Just like that, a random transect, or a series of random transects cutting right across the north of Malta. Irrespective of what archaeological evidence is known to exist over here. We decided to start with the first one. Simply because it was convenient. This is the area of Bidnia. It was convenient to get to, and during visits to the site in the preceding weeks, we realized that it would not have been very difficult to get access to fields simply because there were no massive rubble walls surrounding the sites. Whereas in the area of Bulebel and the area of Marsa Scala, we did know that we might have encountered problems because most of the fields were surrounded by very high walls. I was also concerned by the fact that we were bringing over a Belgian team for 2 weeks, which was going to cost a substantial amount of money, and that we would not be finding anything at all on site. Just because I can't forget this, reading Anthony Luttrell's 1975 introduction to medieval Malta, he said the possibilities of doing field survey in Malta are going to be bedeviled by the fact that a lot of pottery sherds have been collected in the past in order to make the phoon. The waterproofing membrane on traditional farmhouse roofs. And I said, well, we'll have to take a massive risk of bringing over our colleagues and perhaps not finding anything. That was number one. The second nightmare, and this was really a nightmare, in other words, not being able to sleep at night. I thought that we would encounter problems with the farmers. I can't tell you how pleased we were to find their support during the 2 weeks that we spent in the field. The farmers were very glad to have us there. We did not encounter any problems whatsoever. The only thing is that we spent a lot of time explaining to individual farmers what we were doing. And practically all my time during those 2 weeks, every morning, was spent talking to farmers. And unfortunately, hearing about the problems that they face. I don't know how many invoices I saw from the Pitkali and the ridiculous amount of money that they get for the produce. And I would really like to thank them publicly because they were extremely, extremely helpful in our work. I don't have any pictures of them because I did not turn up with a camera, of course, when I was speaking to them. It was all done by gestures and first-hand encounters. Okay, next slide. If you can go one back, in surveys abroad, usually once you decide on the transect, which could be a kilometer wide or a 500 meter wide transect, you need to set up a grid, which is where you walk. Luckily, Malta's countryside has already been parcelled out for us, and it has been parcelled out in this manner, in fields. Small, they are managed by farmers, and therefore we did not have to worry about defining the edges. And what we had to do, once the tract was identified, to walk in a straight line in the fields. And the spacing was 10 meters. So you walked, and the next walker would be 10 meters away. And you collected only what you could see while walking. In other words, you could not move left or right, but you had to stay on the straight line and collect whatever was found on that straight line. So in other words, we are not collecting everything that there is in the field, but we're collecting a sample of it. And therefore, we're leaving on the surface of the field whatever else remains. Remember that once you remove things from the field, it's not as though they're going to grow back, even though ploughing might bring up to the surface even more pottery sherds, which explains perhaps why, even though people have been collecting pottery sherds in the past, pottery still was identified during our survey. So, as I said, we started off with one transect, and we can zoom in the area where we did our work. This is a map showing you the road leading up to Bidnia from São Paulo da Tarja up to Bidnia there, and we carried out a survey in the fields that you see shaded in this manner. The red areas are those areas where access was impossible, either because one or two farmers did not allow us in, or because there are buildings now which cover the areas that you see over here. So roughly we covered in 2 weeks of intensive surveying by a team of about 25, we covered just over 1 kilometer squared. And even though we started off with this vast idea of having four massive transects running north-south, we now know that we need to sit down and see whether we can change our strategy, because it was very time-consuming. But we did get interesting and exciting results. In the distance, this is Jebel Awzara over here, and Tal and Bidnia and Haldrag would be just off screen. As I said, we chose randomly, so we know that some areas will just fall off our transect, but we can't do anything about it. We decided to be random in our choice. We also wanted, and we did this specifically, to choose an area for which we knew there was documentary evidence. And for instance, you see here an image from an early 18th century property book. All the area of Bidnia belonged to the church, and there are property books in the Curia showing the landholdings there. In actual fact, the farmers in the area are mostly tenants, land which is now managed by the joint office. And you can see that some of the farmhouses, the few farmhouses which were present in the 18th century in the area, now there are even more buildings. Some of them sport the have encased in their walls a plaque with a date. This says 1783, but you can't see it, and it has the sign of the cathedral, of the Medina Cathedral. So these are cathedral lands. And just to point out this area, the cluster of trees that you see here, this is the olive grove that exists at Bidnia. These are massive olive trees, which are quite a characteristic. They're protected in Bidnia, and these are over here. So the document resources can inform us and can tell us what has been happening to the land at least over the last 200, 300 years. That is very, very useful information, and we are glad to have it. One of our graduate students will be looking at this area in detail for his work. This is the area, and in the next slide you have a picture. This is the olive grove here. Just on the right hand side of the image here, and these are students who are surveying in this area here. What are the results of our two week survey? As I said, even though we were worried that we might not find much on the surface, we did find quite a lot, and this came initially as a surprise. Once you look for the material, it is in fact there. And we did collect in 2 weeks more than 21,000 potsherds. A huge amount by all means. Some of it abraded, but some of it quite diagnostic. So this is quite interesting, because as Nathaniel Kutayar would point out, the idea today is not just to manage single monuments, single archaeological sites, but to look at sites in their landscape context. And if you want to know what there is out there in the landscape, rather than wait for construction works to start and then intervening when it might be a bit too late, with an exercise like this, the material will be available with the superintendents and perhaps even with the Malta Environment and Planning Authority, so that they will have the information available in order to decide whether works can go ahead when, for instance, substantial pottery scatters are known to exist in a particular area. So pottery is there, and in the picture over here you can see what pottery might look like. If it starts raining, then it's better, because the pots would have been washed and therefore they are bright red. And of course, if the fields have been ploughed, that is even better still, because material can be brought up to the surface. This gives you an idea of the number of sherds that have been collected from particular fields. As I said, red are the areas where we're either not allowed access, or else where buildings are on top. This diagram that you see here has not yet been weighted according to visibility. In some fields, visibility is very poor because there's a lot of overgrowth. So this picture here still needs to be weighted according to visibility. But immediately you see that certain areas have very large concentrations, more than 500 sherds, for example, in this field and in another field over here. We know that, ignore this red spot, that should be very dark brown, we know that in this area we found a lot of pottery as well. Now, of course, we really need to take into consideration processes of deposition. How do pots end up on the surface of a field? And of course, when you look at something like this, a field over here, and you find 500 sherds, then you say it is very likely that under the ground there might be an archaeological site which lies buried. But of course, with a major road passing very close by and with a number of side lanes leading into it, you also have to keep in mind that soil might have been brought from somewhere else and dumped there. So these are problems that we have to keep constantly in mind. For example, interviewing farmers in this area, we were told that during construction projects, going back as far as the 1970s, a lot of material, a lot of soil was brought over here from the Ta'ali area, for example. So our exercise is not just about collecting pottery, but also about interviewing people, and keeping in mind that our results might be somehow skewed because of more recent depositional processes. However, as part of the exercise, we decided to put particular attention on the area over here, which is very near to the olive groves, the area where the olive groves are situated. Of course, the project will continue this year in September, and we intend to cover all the other areas. We can't simply say this is where things seem to be happening. We just have to walk right across this transect. And even areas which are bare rock, garrigue, for example, provided us with quite a few surprises. So you really think that you know the area very well, and yet material was still being found. And in one particular area, two zones in fact, in Bidnia, were selected for geophysical prospection using what we call a georadar. In other words, we can look at what is underground using a complicated piece of equipment, which our colleagues from Belgium brought over in the car with them, and the results were quite interesting. And the first zone is these are the olive trees over here. This would be the plateau, the garrigue area here, and just below that we carried out a geophysical survey in two spots. One of them, this red dot over here, corresponds to a big, quite a large hole in the ground, which is nicely mortared in a waterproofing material, and in which there was a lot of of pieces of caccio pesto. And we think that this is quite an interesting area. There might be a cistern over here, partly covered over, and therefore we thought that it was worth looking at it in a little bit of detail. And this is the sort of result that you get. Looking underground, the white areas are either bedrock or else rock, and the darker ones are hollows. Next slide, please. And the suggestion is that the cistern, which is visible on the ground, actually continues further. We can see that the rectangular continues quite a long distance. It might be completely filled in, perhaps with rock itself, or perhaps it might be roofed over with slabs, which is why we get this this effect in the geophysics. The channeling system that you can see on the surface, you can see these straight lines on the rock face, might either be a channeling system for water to be collected somewhere. I can't be sure that the water is being channeled over here. Or else there is substantial rock quarrying in the area, and as you know, quarries are characterized by channels, which is where the pick is cuts channels, and then blocks of stone are wedged away from the bedrock itself. So that might be the channeling system in bedrock. There might even be structures, because the result is very bright and white in two areas, although that could also be bedrock too. What am I trying to point out over here? That with this sort of work, we can decide that rather than spending a lot of time excavating anywhere blindly, we can actually focus, pinpoint, and almost carry out keyhole surgery on select areas. This is something that is done worldwide by archaeologists, and of course it is very cost effective, because rather than spend a lot of time, especially when you have very, very large areas, you can pinpoint what you want to explore. Next. The other area is immediately above the grove. We have known for a long time that this area here is the site of probably a Roman villa. Already in 1911 and 1912, in the museum annual report, there is a note saying that a trapetum, an olive so-called olive picker or olive crusher had been discovered, pottery scatters have long been noted. Colleague Timmy Gambin here had done a survey of the grove itself, had noted pottery scatters a few years back, and it was therefore not surprising that there was a vast concentration of pottery in this area, immediately over here. But of course, we thought it would be good not only to collect all the pottery from the field, therefore not just sticking to lines 10 meters apart, but collecting all the pottery, we call it a block survey, but also doing the geophysics over here, especially in this field, in this upper field. Unfortunately, this is completely inaccessible, this area over here, because of a lot of overgrowth. We were very lucky that the tenants, all this area split up between different farmers, but the tenants were very helpful and understanding in actually allowing us over here. You would be spotted from miles away within minutes. So there was no way that the farmers would not know that you are there. The word would quickly go around, and therefore the best way was to inform them in advance and by telephone, and I can assure you it was not an easy job to find who they were and to try and talk to them in person. Next slide should be showing us the results of the survey done in this field over here, where it is very, very clear and apparent that you have rectilinear, something rectilinear there. We could retrace already some features which we knew existed. But also, it is very clear that at the end of the field, there is a large rectangular structure. To those of you who know the area, there is a large growth of bamboo or canes here, and the reason being that there is an important water source that starts from just below the escarpment and fills in a number of tanks over here. This water source is already visible in the early 18th century property book of the church. It is a very, very important feature of the area, and I suspect that the growth of canes is actually concealing structural remains underneath. And there are even other remains, as you can see in the picture there. Next. We knew about this this item. I had seen it many years ago, possibly with Professor Bonanno, and we could not retrace it more recently, because luckily the farmers had had covered it, and it is something that we did after taking this photograph and making a drawing. This had already been mentioned in the 1911-1912 Museum Annual Report, and it is of the type, it is a stone container of the type that is known also at St. Paul Millier. And usually in an olive pressing farmstead installation, you do have vats of this sort to allow the oil to settle in them after pressing. This is particularly a good example, because it even has a low rim around the edge, which is where the wooden lid would have been placed. The slide, the next slide, this is a picture, an image drawn by Renata Zarafa. You can see how beautiful it is in section, and it has this sort of sump at the bottom for sediment to collect there. And you can see also the bit of the rim here. So we did manage to relocate this important item. For many years, I thought that it had been taken away, it had been stolen, but in actual fact, it is still there, and we made sure that it is not easily found. The arrows over here show possible structures related to the rural installation. We're calling it villa, but we are certainly not sure about this, but definitely you can make out the white parts in this, I can call it an X-ray almost. Next. The circles which can be easily made out are lines of trees, modern olive trees. And perhaps, therefore, it is not surprising that we're finding a lot of pottery on the surface, because olive trees were planted not many years ago, and planting trees would have meant bringing to the surface a lot of the sherds which were lying underground. We hope that not a lot of damage has been done to the archaeology below. There is also a linear, we call it anomaly, that you see over here. This is the location of the vat that I have just shown you. So this is a linear, probably a wall. As I said, we know that the archaeology is there. We are not in any particular rush to dig the site, but it is good for heritage managers to know that this exists, so that we can actually protect it. Yeah, the suggestion is that we might be dealing with an irrigation drain, perhaps, in this area. The person who is doing this exercise, doing the GPR surveys, is doing the exercise as part of his doctoral research. And the idea is to select a number of sites in Malta, ones which we are actually exploring, and to see the different type of results he gets in different types of terrain at different times of the year. And in some areas, certainly at Ar-Rsheikh, in Gozo, and in Zeytoun, the idea is to dig certain areas to be able to compare the geophysical results with what is actually underground, in order to be able to fine-tune our skills at interpreting something like this. So comparing the X-rays with what is actually underground. So as you can see, we are all learning as we go along, and this is what is exciting. Once you try to learn, there has to be collaboration, because you are exploring uncharted territory, terrain, and so on and so forth. So this is something that Professor Bonanno mentioned. The beauty of the project is that there is constant respect, mutual respect, for different members of the team, starting from the student to the project directors. And I think that is a very, very healthy aspect of this project. And we hope that this will continue in years to come. Another thing that we can reflect on is the photograph that you see over here shows three rural sites with structures. This is the first area that we looked at. This is the second area where the olive trees are. And the third area is possibly where that large concentration of pottery is located, but the area where we have certain doubts as to whether the material was brought in and dumped from the road. However, having said that, we also know that we have a number of tombs existing in this same area. And as you know, pottery sherds can actually be moved around, can be carted, can be thrown on a manure heap, and then manure gets sprinkled over different fields, but tombs do not move. And that if there is one thing about doing work related to Malta, is that we do get along a number of rock cut features, including cart ruts, including quarries, including tombs. And even though sometimes it might be difficult to date rock cut features, simply because cutting rock cut features has hardly changed before the invention of the pneumatic drill, they do show activity tied to one specific area. And in the area just above the olive grove, we have rock cut tombs. And this is one example. It is perched really dangerously on the edge of the escarpment. As you can see, these are the olive trees over here. So we're looking just above. Behind where I'm taking the photo from, there is another tomb. And in fact, the shaft of that tomb is rectangular, whereas the shaft of this tomb is, as you can see, circular. You go down, and you have an underground chamber. And you have a drawing which was done very, very quickly for this presentation to give you an idea of what we are looking at. So shaft and chamber, shaft and chamber. Now, of course, unfortunately, these tombs are empty, even though we will not know for sure until we actually clear them. And the likelihood is that they were rifled many, many years ago. But the shape and the location will be very informative. and the shape of this tomb would probably date to around about the year 600 BC or thereabouts. So despite the fact that the villa might be Roman in date, the villa just a few meters away might be Roman in date, we might have Punic activity in this area starting many years before. And that is quite an exciting part of the project. The tomb, not very far away from this one, a few meters away, is, as I said, very different. That has a rectangular shaft. The chamber, I do not know, but I will hopefully find out when I will get some students to help me. There's a nasty fig tree in the way, and we need to prune it. If we can go back just two slides, another one. Uh-huh. There are other tombs in the area, and by the way, these are unrecorded tombs. We did not know about them, so despite the fact that, you know, we always say we've looked well at Malta's landscape, there might be surprises. And in this spot over here, for example, completely surrounded by fields, there is only one rock outcrop, a knoll, just one outcrop. Within that outcrop, there is a rock-cut tomb, possibly of Punic, if not Roman date. There's absolutely nothing around it, just terraced fields. And yet, one rock outcrop has this rock-cut tomb, and there's another rock-cut tomb on the way up to Vidnia on the left-hand side. It's completely covered over with stones, but these are all exciting, because remember, tombs must be associated with some sort of settlement, some sort of farm or farmstead. It is a pattern we even find, for example, at the Takachatura villa, or even at the Zaytun villa. You have a villa site, but tombs are known to exist in the immediate vicinity. So we are keeping our eyes wide open for structural remains, and even these pointers will tell us whether we will interpret correctly the number of pottery sherds that we collect from the immediate area before sending out our colleague Leven to do the geophysics. It is important that we look for the markers and for the number of sherds on the surface of the fields. This is, of course, the second part of our work. We collect the pottery in the field and any other object we bring in, and then the fun bit starts. And the fun bit I say fun because it's actually quite taxing, and it can appear boring, because one thing, collecting 21,000 sherds, and of course there is a lot of note taking in the field to make sure that the right information is put in the data in the sheets, data capture sheets we have, to make sure that every single person puts in the pottery in his or her own bag, and that gets stacked properly, and so on and so forth. Then, of course, we get the specialists to look at the pottery. And this is where I said the fun bit starts. Why is it fun? Because in the picture here you see two Dutch colleagues. Roald is the person that you see here. Winfried is an expert on Greek pottery. Boutaina is a colleague from Tunisia. And we had other people working on this. We had Nathaniel looking at medieval pottery too. And the good thing is that it is a constant learning process for all of us. And of course, you have to compare what you find on the surface of the fields, often abraded, with known archaeological contexts. So for us, it is good that we can rely on the reference collection we have in the department, which comes from 10 campaigns, excavation campaigns at Tassilch, and also from our excavations at the villa in Zaytun, where we have select good stratigraphic units, good archaeological contexts, and we can start comparing like with like. We managed to inventorize 6,000 sherds in 2 weeks. 6,000 sherds have been looked at in detail, and that is quite positive. And the good thing is that students can actually take part in this activity. We want to fine-tune this in the next season. Royal and I are not happy that the training is going down to everyone enough, and we hope to spend a little bit, perhaps, more time on training in the coming season, even if it means looking at less material, because it does take a while to get used to the type of shirts that you find. It's not something that you learn very, very quickly. Next slide, please. And everything gets inputted in a database. Copies are kept with all members of the project, the superintendents, Ghent University, and the university here has a copy, and all the pottery is kept at the university in our stores, and we hope to continue with the study in the near future. We'll be having a study season, which will only be a week or two, hopefully before or after Easter. And this is the sort of material that we are coming up with. Of course, there's a lot of tiny shirts, which of course I'm not showing you. Because they're not beautiful or anything of the sort. But over here you can get an idea of the type of exciting pieces that we get. Certainly amphorae rims that you see over here, probably imported even from Campania. Some are neo-Punic, from North Africa. Next slide. We have even some fine wares coming from the block survey carried out in the area where we think the villa is located underground. And we even have some medieval pottery. Nathaniel tells us that we might be looking at pieces from the 8th to the 10th century, possibly from the 10th to the 12th, a base with glaze that you see over here. So all of a sudden we're really finding interesting material. Of course, a lot of other activity has been happening over the last 10 years in Malta. So we're not looking at pottery in complete isolation, but we're looking at pottery from the survey and comparing it to a lot of archaeology which has been recovered from rural sites over the last few years. The superintendent is involved with monitoring and directing the monitoring of a number of sites. A lot of exciting archaeology has come up, and therefore pottery like this is being compared to those results in areas which are not very far away from Bednia, for example. We even found a piece of a lamp. My Belgian colleagues think that it is of Punic date. We're not sure that is correct, but as I said, we will be looking over the next months also at pottery which is stored at the National Museum of Archaeology in order to compare, as I said, like with like, and also looking at the stores of the superintendents for periods which are not represented in our reference collection at the university. But from the pictures I have shown you, I just simply want to give you a taste of what is being found and to convince you that the material is there. This piece, for example, was found in an area which is bare rock. And if you go on all fours, it is very likely that you will find the material. Interpreting how things have come where they happen to be is, of course, part of the exercise. We even found pieces of brick, fired brick, during the field walking. And part of our exercise is going to be looking also at the fabric of the shirts. It is not enough sometimes to look at the surface of the pot using the naked eye, but preferably we should be looking at the shirts microscopically. We want to try and identify what is local and what is foreign. We have already done an interesting exercise with material from Tassilch. We would like to extend it further, and it is something that is a major desideratum to have this reference collection, as I mentioned earlier, of shirts from known archaeological contexts of a known date, so that we can compare the stuff we encounter during our survey to it. And we can even go by fabric. For example, you can see over here very interesting inclusions. I'm not an expert, by all means, but I know this is something which gets the specialists going and quite excited, because they can identify sometimes foreign imports on the basis of the inclusions in the shirt. Okay? I conclude by a word of thanks to the soldiers on the ground. A project like this can never materialize without without the funding first. The funding is crucial in order to keep us all going. I would also like to thank the Belgian embassy. The ambassador took a very keen interest in the project when it was in its very early stages and when we thought we were not going to get anywhere in the beginning. The Belgian ambassador was very, very helpful and very encouraging, and we had several meetings, and he said it will be good for Malta. You're looking at the landscape rather than concentrating on sites. So the money was there, but of course nothing can be done without the permission of the farmers, of the tenant farmers to enter the fields, and also of the students. It might look like a very straightforward and simple exercise, but in actual fact, there's a lot of discipline involved in keeping to your line, in making sure that the forms are filled properly, not risking one's life like this guy is doing over here. And it was amazing to see so many young people taking part in this exercise and extending their work period to going swimming together, visiting archaeological sites together, and keeping very active on Facebook, on the web. I can thank many people who are here, who took part in the exercise, Renata, Iona, Maverick, Maxine, Marvin. I'm sure I would have left many others, all the second and third year students. Nothing would be possible without their input. This is something that is worth mentioning over and over again. None of this work is possible. It's very likely that when a book or an article will come out, it will have to be written by the specialists and by a select few. But in actual fact, it is the work of every individual that makes an exercise like this possible. Roald tells me that there should be funding for this project until 2012, so it is the beginning of a very exciting collaboration. And I would like to thank everyone, and you in particular, who came here to listen to what we had to tell you about this project. Thank you.
You have just listened to a talk organized by the Archaeological Society of Malta entitled The Malta Survey Project 2008, Scope and Preliminary Results of a Joint Belgian-Maltese Fieldwalking Survey in Northern Malta.